you said that the women stayed home. Were there any mothers who were going out and working?
Yes. My girlfriend, Figgy Drash, a 20 major. Her mother was a widow, very young. She had Faggy, and her husband died when Milton wasn't quite a year old. And she had to go to work. So she worked full-time, and Faggy was cared by her grandfather and grandmother. And so she always worked full-time. She never remarried until she must have been in her late 60s or 70s.
Oh, my God.
And she worked in a dress shop all those years.
How about across the street?
Across the road, Sandra Ellis's mother worked, but she was brought up by her grandparents.
So the women?
Most of the other women stayed home.
There were a few bootleggers.
Yeah, there were bootleggers.
Okay. You know what? Since you mentioned that, one of the things I want to talk about is any kind of home industry. So talk about the bootlegging or
well, there was the bootleggers, they're passed away now, Skies. They were the bootleggers across the road. Home industry, my mother would make, but it wasn't really an industry, it would come Christmas time, and we had a big coal stove in the kitchen, and my cousin would ask her to make turkeys for his Christmas parties. Because my mother would cook and help out in catering and that. So she would make the turkeys. I don't know of too many women who, if they weren't working outside the or families that had industry in the house, there was just too many people living in a house to really have an industry going in the house. There may have been further up the street, but I didn't know of any in my little area, because everybody went out, you know, the men were out working, and maybe the women were minding somebody else's kids, but it was on a loose.
He had three jobs.
It wasn't like now. My father worked three jobs. He made shoes in those years, like worked for three different companies. So you worked, and when they came from Europe, they were all Orthodox. He didn't work Saturday. But in order to make a living, a lot of them changed, and they worked Saturday because they had to feed their families. So things started changing. There were
out
a number
of necessity,
of,
you're saying,
out of necessity with a lot of them.
Yeah,
yeah. But as far as small, except for the storekeepers, and the women would work in the stores with the men, and sometimes the women were the ones working the stores. The men were at another job. So it wasn't always...
So the women officially were not working, but often they were.
They were.
Because you just needed to bring...
My mother worked in the house. Because we rented out later on all these rooms, she provided all the linens, and they had cooking plates. So my mother would clean all the rooms, wash and iron all the linens, and clean a three-story house. I came home from school one day. She's pregnant with my brother. I was 12 years old. And I find her on a ladder. And the ceilings on our house on Major Street, my mother was not 5 feet. She's 8 or 9 months pregnant. She's standing on the top of a ladder cleaning a ceiling. I came home from school at lunchtime, and I got so nervous. What are you doing on a ladder? I mean... I was only 12, but I know she shouldn't have been on a ladder. I had to go get the man next door, Mr. Cowan, to come in, and we should bring her off the ladder. What if she would have fallen? I mean, the women in those days were really crazy.
They were. They were strong.
They were strong. They worked like horses. They didn't go out to work. They worked. They cooked. They cleaned. They never had time to go out. My mother gave birth to my brother in January. He just turned 65. My girlfriend Annette, who became my stepsister because my father married her mother. They lived at 10 Ulster Street. So her mother, Mamie, had her fourth child, a son, on March 17th. Well, do you think that those mothers ever walked those children outside? They didn't have time. And at night, we used to walk the kids outside in the carriages.
Because the mothers were working.
They were too busy in the house working, cooking, baking.
Yeah.
They never had time. They didn't, they really, if you ask them, did you know your neighbors? Yeah, I went outside and I said, hi. The only neighbors they would know is our friends' parents. But there wasn't where they would go in and visit with a neighbor.
Yeah.
They didn't have the time to do any of that. They really didn't. She knew Faggy, like Frida Drash, because a lot of times my mother would take the kids in to help look after them, and if she was going out on a date, they would sleep over or something like that, you know.
And the families helped each other.
I mean, very much so.
Everybody was busy with their own families.
But they all helped as much as you could. Like, down the street was the Wymans, the Greenstein. Like, there were certain people that were friends before, and they stayed friends or family, and you made friendships with different people.
I have the impression that if you live near Harvard, or you live near Bloor, or you, being near college, that your life very much was on the street you lived on, but the East-West Street was the one you lived closest to.
Yeah.
You didn't use the whole neighborhood as much.
Well, it depends on where the friends were. So my friends went all the way up to basically Harvard, and a few that were closer to Bloor.
All the way up to Harvard.
Yeah, and my cousin Dorothy lived on Borden.
Yeah.
Like 197. So, she went to school at Lansdowne instead of King Edward. So, and her brother Gary, late brother Gary, also went to school there. So you made friends with, even though they weren't on your street, I had friends who lived on Brunswick, on Robert, on Borden, Lippincott, friends who lived south of college that I'd go with. But your life and the people you knew was maybe in that whole block. You knew them really well. If you went to school with them. If you didn't, they were passing. Like Jerry's cousin, Edith Strutz, married Dr. Frank Birnbaum. His parents lived on Major Street. And we would always see Frank's father, Mr. Birnbaum, walking up and down Major. He was friendly with my father and mother. He'd come in and say hello. This man lived to be 100. Then the Smalls lived on Ulster, I believe. Their daughter, Ethel Small, married my cousin, Harry Wasserman. And they have their son was Dr. Small, a dermatologist. My cousin, Harry's son, became a dermatologist, Gary Wasserman. So there were people who would go up and down the street that you knew, but they were older than us, and I knew them because of my parents.
But you know, as you're saying, doctor this and doctor that, I'm seeing that as the generations went on, there were more and more well-educated young people.
Right, because in my family, my brother Sheldon is the first lawyer. And in those days, like, I went as far as third form high school. I went to Commerce.
So wait a minute. Third form means what grade?
11.
How old were you? Okay.
16.
Okay, because they're not using that word anymore.
So I finished third year Commerce, and my husband and I were engaged. We were going to stay here engaged by 17. And my mother said, I wanted to finish school, but I had a job. And she said, well, maybe you should go to work because we need the money for Sheldon to go to university.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I'm 6 years older than my brother, the next one. So I said, Mom, I'm getting married. I have a good job. Yeah, what's the difference? I'll go to work. So I never got my diploma. So I never finished fourth year Commerce. And I went to work. Sheldon went on to go to Harvard and go on to be a lawyer. And that was the dream of every parent, was if they had a son, daughters, no, but sons, they had a doctor, a lawyer, and an accountant, or a dentist. And that was every mother's dream.
Especially fathers. The immigrants.
Exactly.
That was a measure of success.
A measure of success was if your son became a professional. If your daughter married the professional, it was even better. But they never looked to your daughter becoming a professional. There were a number of my friends that did go to Harvard that went on to have professional lives. They became therapists.
Like physiotherapists,
social workers, physiotherapists, social workers.
Teachers?
Teachers. None of my personal friends became lawyers. Or doctors.
Yeah.
But a later generation, like by the time Sheldon, 6 years later, it had already moved a little more. And by, honey, even a year difference, there was more. And by the time my brother came around, 12 years later, my youngest brother, so you've got another generation, you've got more doctors, rabbis. It all turned over. Like my brother Sheldon became a lawyer, and his three best friends, two became doctors and another one became a lawyer. So, and they're still friends to today. So that, this like 6 years, 7 years in age made a lot of difference in the families. And again, it depended on what your family did as a living. Because if you worked in the factory and you were barely getting by and you managed to own a house, you did pretty good. And you didn't say, well, I can, you put everything into your children.
Yeah.
So you wanted your children to have what you didn't have, and that they should have a profession because that would guarantee them a good living.
So there were expectations, especially for the son.
Very.
Well, and those expectations, as you say, for you, just 6 years older than the next brother, was to marry well.
Right.
Be able to hold a good job and marry somebody who could take care
of the family.
There
was never any doubt in your parents' mind that being a girl that you would get married. There was no such thing, you're not going to get married. You know, today you don't think that way. In those days, and the boys had to have a profession because they had to make a living. So that was the progression. And the girls, we went out to commerce. Most of us went to commercial school. We were secretaries, bookkeepers, and the odd one went on to accounting. They finished commerce, but they went on. Got higher degrees, even, you know, just kept going to school.
But you were all expected to get married and have children, but hopefully have some skills so you could earn some money too.
The expectation is that you would earn the money before you went to get married. The thought that you would have to work after you got married, that you would want to work after you got, wasn't really there.
Okay.
So, you would be a housekeeper,
yeah.
If you, because by then you're in your in the 50s, and television had come on, and you're looking at all of these shows with the wonderful mothers who stayed home and looked after the children, and that was the expectation. It wasn't the expectation of, oh, I was going to have another career and go on and do something else. That was something that had to come from you.
So your career was being a good wife and a good mother.
Exactly.
And raising healthy children, and they could be professionals, whatever. But
that was that generation.
And it was honored. It wasn't
definitely
a second-class citizen, I don't think.
No. And then, you know, many of my friends, we got married, and in those days, there was no help. Once you got pregnant, you had to leave your job pretty well. And there was no unemployment insurance. It was nothing. You stayed home with your kids until such time as you, if you had to go back to work, there was no daycare. Maybe there was one or two around the city, but not really.
A creche,
maybe. But if you had a grandmother to look after your children or a friend, so then if you had to go back to work, you went to work. Some of us took in, like I worked after we were married. I didn't have a child for 3 years. So I worked till the end of December, and he was born March. So I never went back to the office to work. And you never got unemployment insurance, nothing.
Yeah.
Your husband was your sole provider and whatever savings you had. But by then, my father was out of the factory, working in the shoes, and he had gone into business buying and selling houses, so he was starting to make a living at that. So I was doing the bookkeeping for that at home. So a lot of us would do work at in the house, bookkeeping or whatever.
Well, that's, you know, we're talking about home industry.
That would be our generation already. That was our generation. Then when the kids, when I had my second son, a lot of our friends, by the time we had the one or two kids, and they were in school all day, a lot of my friends went back to work as secretaries or bookkeepers or whatever. And some went back to school. Some went on to get degrees later on in life. So that was, you know, already you're in the 60s. Things had changed
again. And those certainly were changes. I'd like to talk a little bit about the sidewalks, the back lanes. How were those used, the sidewalks, the back lanes?
Well, the roads? Sidewalks were wonderful. Everybody had a front porch. So you sat on the front porch and you saw everything going on in the street and communicated, and you played on the street, played hopscotch, skipping, whatever. The boys played hockey on the roads. There weren't the amount of cars there are today. So the car came back. Everybody had respect for everybody. And then roller skating on the street, and bicycle riding, whoever could ride a bike and had a bike, on the streets. And we participated in the street. The back lane, we didn't use our back lane. And we, there was a lane behind us.
Was it paved?
No.
Oh, it wasn't paved?
No.
Okay.
No, it was a dirt lane.
Okay.
And we had a garage in back of our house, but it wasn't a usable garage because of the lane sort of ended there. We had a little bit of a backyard. And everybody who had a backyard tried to make a victory garden, sort of, if they could. But a
so
lot of it
means
was mud.
Growing vegetables.
Yeah, because it was during the war.
Right.
And after the war. But it wasn't much of a backyard. Because you're, how much of a backyard do you have here? Maybe it was bigger. I don't know. So you had, if your foot frontage was 15 or 16, and maybe you had another 15 feet to the back lane or something. So the backyards weren't used. They were used to hang your clothes out, and maybe you had a little bit of vegetables out there, and that's all. You used your front porch.
Yeah. Okay, but that's very different from now because
very different.
You talked about the victory gardens where people planted vegetables or fruit or what I planted, and hanging clothes. And,
right.
And it's quite different now.
Very different.
Yeah.
The amount of vegetables that were planted were limited. We all ate, what did we have?
Just whatever you grew or got in the store. There wasn't this flying in of all the foods. So you're very limited in what vegetables over the winter.
Yeah, carrots.
You had potatoes, carrots, onions,
so you say you grew those and you stored
those.
Well,
some of it you grew and some of it you bought and stored.
Right.
So you'd buy, I remember my mother buying 20-pound bags of sugar, 20-pound bags of flour, 20-pound bags of potatoes, carrots, onions, and they were all stored in the basement. My mother would, and in the summer they would buy bushels of fruit because they would can. All the women canned when all the fruits came off and they bought the fruits, they didn't buy a basket. They would buy bushels because they would sit and can. My mother would can hundreds of jars so we'd have fruits all winter long.
So when you talk about these women working hard, that's another example.
No question.
Oh my God. We had coal furnace. Who shoveled coal? You think the men shoveled the coal? The women shoveled the coal. They weren't home.
So they put it into these big bins and then they put it,
that's
the women
right.
put it into the...
Shoveled the coal into the furnace. The women shoveled the coal. If the man was home, he shoveled the coal. But
Jacket heater.
And then we had a jacket heater for heat.
What's a jacket heater?
It was a little stove for hot water. Mm-hmm. And when you needed hot water to take a bath, you took a bath once a week. You turned on the jacket heater. Some places you had to put a quarter in.
Oh my God.
To light it. You had wash tubs. You washed on a washing board. You would give big sheets and stuff out to the laundry. And there was nowhere to hang it. Yeah, small backyard.
How about on Thursday to fish?
Oh, yeah. And then you go shopping on Thursdays in most kosher homes. all the women would go shopping Thursday. They would buy fresh carp.
And where would they buy that carp?
At the fish store.
Where was that?
In Kensington.
Kislik.
Or on Spadina, wherever area you lived in.
So there were fish stores all over.
You bring home fresh fish.
Yeah.
And you would put it in the bathtub. And you would leave it there till Friday morning. And Friday morning you would kill it and scale it and cook it for Friday night dinner. The chickens, you went and you bought the fresh chicken and you took it to the flickering, because that was my job for my aunt and uncle. And they would, you took it first to the shoichet and you got it killed.
Okay, just say what the shoichet is.
The shoichet is a ritual slaughterer. Okay. So you had to get it killed in a certain way.
So you bought it and...
You bought it fresh, you took it to the shoichet, to the ritual
fresh
slaughterer.
Fresh meaning alive.
Alive. You took it to the ritual slaughterer. And then you took it to the flicker, who took the flickers off. Sometimes they'd be in the same place. Sometimes you would go and the chicken place would have it done for you. You could go and get it already done. But a lot of women would prefer to do it that way.
They would want to choose their own chicken?
Choose their own chicken. They had to feel it. And they choose their own fish. They had to kill it.
Wow.
And that's what they did. So when I said that these women worked hard, let me tell you, they worked overdrive.
So the fish would be swimming in your
bathtub? In my bathtub.
And then your mother would be the one to kill it, or your father?
That's my mother. My father didn't know. My father didn't know. Nothing. The men in those days went to work. If they knew how to boil water, you were very lucky. Because they didn't do anything.
What do you mean anything?
They didn't do any housework. They didn't cook. They didn't clean. Nothing.
So it was a very clear division of labor.
Very, very clear division.
You know, kind of Jane and Tarzan, and Jane does this and Tarzan does that.
Well, the woman was definitely the hard... worked. The men worked hard. I would say the women worked harder.
Well, it's a lot of... I mean, what you're describing, plus taking care of the kids.
Yeah.
And the laundry.
And the baking.
Yeah.
And the cooking. And in the my mother made her own cream, her own butter during the war. Because you couldn't get a lot of this stuff. So you only ate what you could buy. You couldn't get the fresh fruits and vegetables and all the food you see today. There was just no way.
Yeah, right, right. They weren't importing it from Mexico.
No way.
None of it.
You got oranges, oh my God. And the oranges, there wasn't toilet paper like there is today. Oranges came in a crinkly orange paper.
I remember.
That was used in the toilet. And so was the newspapers.
Oh.
The Jewish newspapers. And if you read an English newspaper, they were torn up. That's what you used in the toilet.
It's true.
It didn't block the toilets?
Maybe it blocked them.
With 12 people sharing two toilets?
Well, maybe we had some toilet paper later on.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Basically, that's what you used.
Yeah.
Everything was recycled. The oranges came in these orange crates. Okay, so the orange crates became your dressing table or your dresser because you could use the shelves. So people would put them together and put a top over
seats,
it.
Seats in the back of the truck.
Seats in the back of the truck.
Or else these toys that people would put wheels on.
The kids would play in them.
Yeah.
They'd play in the boxes. Who had the toys that you have today?
So recycling happened long before the word came around.
Oh my God.
Like it was happening. You're talking about 70 years ago, you were really recycling.
Recycling.
Yeah.
Women didn't go to the store and buy Modus and Kodak. They recycled rags.
Whoa. And then washed them.
That's right.
Yeah.
My generation already went and bought, but my mother's generation, no.
So recycling was...
It's an old story.
As old as prostitution.
We grew up, my mother or my cousins, they made these wonderful shopping bags. You went to the store with your own shopping bag. The baker, we had home delivery for bakers. There was bakers that would deliver the bread, so that was in a paper bag. The milkman would come with the milk that was in the glass jar.
How did the milkman come?
What, by what was, If they had a horse and wagon, later it became a truck.
Okay, but the baker started with off when you were a child. It was horse and wagon.
Yeah.
The tea man till my mother moved away. In the 50s. Flowerdale Tea.
Yeah.
He would deliver tea to the house. It was a horse and wagon. Until the 50s.
So that's another huge... When I talked about the sidewalks and the roads, you talked about kids playing, people gathering and sitting on the front porches.
And all the deliveries.
But all these deliveries with horses.
Horse and wagons, and then his father had a horse and wagon, then they graduated to a truck. But they started out with horse and wagons. The milk I think by the only horse and wagon delivery we had on Major already that I remember... First was the baker, he got a truck. I think Mr. K already had a truck. The milkman,
so.
Maybe. But the Flowerdale Tea was the funniest because he was delivering forever. A little green truck with a horse.
And what about the ice? Was that
the iceman would come too, the horse and wagon, and then with the truck.
Yeah.
But we graduated to a fridge, or we got a Frigidaire. I think we must have been in the house a few years, 2-3 years, till we got a fridge. And then my mother took the coal stove down to the basement and we got a gas stove.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you moved from coal to gas.
Right, and then we moved from coal furnace to oil heat.
Mm-hmm.
Peace heating, it was called.
Peace.
P-A-C-E.
Yeah.
So we had an oil furnace.
So they schlepped all that other dirty stuff out
and
replaced it.
With oil.
Yeah.
You got rid of the space that was used, that the coal used to take.
Yeah. But basically your cellar was a cellar. My girlfriend, who later became my stepsister, my stepmother, they had a brand new house at 10 Ulster. There's those two little houses, 10 and 8 and 10. And they bought that house when it was being built. And they moved in there. And that house had a finished basement, a recreation room. Now that, my mother and my stepmother both couldn't say recreation room. It was a decoration room. And like that house was more modern already. It had a very nice kitchen like you have here. With tiles and that. And they had a living room and a dining area, kitchen dining area and a bedroom. Then they had rooms upstairs and they rented a flat upstairs too. And we used to have parties in the decoration room and the recreation room.
Very cute.
But most of the basements were basements. That was the only house we knew that you could go downstairs.
So it was kind of a rough place where you could put all the vegetables downstairs.
Right.
Yeah.
And the furnace.
Yeah.
And some of them weren't... The basements were really low, and you sort of had to crouch. For my parents, it was always high enough because they were 5 feet tall. But other people had to crouch in a lot of basements.
Yeah.
But they weren't livable spaces.
Yeah. So they were used for stuff, but certainly not for
really living.
Most of them got dug out.
Yeah.
Got dug out afterwards.
Eventually. Yeah.
Some had trap doors. Some had trap doors and a ladder.
Uh-huh.
To go in the basement.
Right.
We had stairs.
Yeah.
We had stairs going up to the second floor, off the kitchen also, because it was a big house.
Mm-hmm.
But that wasn't necessarily every house.
Can you talk about the renovations? You just mentioned having the ladder or those who had stairs or this person who had, as you say, as your mother said, the decoration room. What renovations were you aware of that began to happen towards the end of your living in this area?
Well, when we moved in, there most of these houses in the area had two kitchens and one bathroom because you moved into the main floor and you rented out the second floor. If you had a third floor, you rented that out too. So you would have a family like 4-6 living in 2-3 rooms, and in order to pay for your house, you'd rent out the flats. Later on, you started upgrading. So the original kitchens in a lot of houses were a sink, and that's it. You brought your own furniture into the kitchen. So you'd have like a, I don't even know how you say, a cabinet, a shunk. So you'd see these old cabinets that you'd put dishes in, and then they had a drawer that would pull out, like an extra table that you'd prepare food or bake on. Mm-hmm. So you had a sink, a stove, an ice box. Then you graduated to a fridge. Then maybe you graduated to some cupboards in the kitchen, other than that thing. Then later on, they started modernizing, because so you had kitchen cupboards,
really?
Uppers so and lowers.
They provided the sink, that was it, and the rest, at first.
That's all you had, yeah, there was a sink, and you had to bring everything else. So some, you do your dishes, so you pull over a chair, and maybe you wash the dish there, and rinse it here, or wash it on the chair and rinse it in the sink. You'd brush your teeth in the sink because you only had one toilet for everybody. You'd wash your hands and face. You couldn't line up for the bath. You'd never get to work or to school.
Yeah.
So
the bathroom was used for the toilet or the once a week
and
bath.
And the bath.
Yeah.
And if you were lucky enough to get in there before anybody else, there was a sink in there you'd wash.
I think your father used the kitchen.
To take a shave. Because you couldn't. And, you know, everybody's rushing to go to work. You get up at 5, you know, my father had to be at work at 7, you get up at 5 o'clock because he took the streetcar wherever he went. The man upstairs worked at Tip Top Tailors down at the lakeshore. Mm-hmm. He would be up at 5 o'clock in the morning because he had to be at work. So the kitchen was the central point
for cleaning. And the sink was used
for everything, not just for washing dishes and preparing food. Yeah. So your kitchen was minimal, then everything started to upgrade. And we all had hardwood floors, paint and wallpaper. You know, like my cousin Dorothy's father was a painter, so every few years you'd upgrade and paint something. And then as you families got more money, they would upgrade the kitchen, they would upgrade a bathroom. See, when my father and mother already were moving out of Major Street and going into renovation, they were buying and selling old houses and fixing them up. So fixing them up was, they would buy a house, an older house like on Major Blue or wherever, and they would, if there wasn't two kitchens, nice kitchens, they would make, the carpenter would make uppers and lowers in the kitchen, a new floor, put in a sink, toilets, they would upgrade the toilets, put in bathtub, sink, toilet, make sure that all the floors are done, that everything is painted, the roof is done, the furnace is in. We start putting in gas furnaces wherever you could, not oil. Mm-hmm. So everything in the 50s and 60s already, people started to upgrade their homes and renovating, and you had a new wave of immigrants coming in. So you had all the Italians coming in after the war, and they were buying the homes, or whatever ethnicity was coming in after the war, they would start buying houses, and you were able to sell them. And they, again, would be the immigrant. They would live on the main floor, they would rent the second floor, so they'd be able to pay their mortgages.
So they did what you did.
They did exactly what we did.
And that's what immigrants do.
That's right.
Yeah.
But we gave them.
We gave them a better quality of home than we had.
Uh-huh.
They already had maybe two bathrooms.
Yeah.
Two kitchens that were really kitchens.
Right.
So, and they had cupboards and things. Because when the original homes, if you ever saw them, they weren't great. So the renovation started 50s, 60s. Everybody started upgrading. You got everything started moving north, east, west. And you had the newer homes. And the people with money always had the bigger homes and the nicer places. And your working stiffs, you know, upgraded as they went along.
Now, you're talking about everybody working so hard. Were you...
In terms of your own adolescence, and you've been dating since what age? The two
16.
16. And how old were you when you got engaged?
17, 18. 18, we got married at 19.
I never got engaged. I asked her to go steady. She said, no, not unless they could marry me.
You drive a hard bargain.
I think we were 17.
Oh, my God. And then you got married at 19. You were both 19?
Yeah. Just short of 20.
Oh, my God.
Got married March 28th. He turned 20 May 1st, and I turned 20 in August. Wow.
Okay, so talk to me, please, about dating at that time.
Dating was interesting. A lot of group dating. You would meet at the Y
or
B'nai B'rith.
And where
we
had
class
at that time?
The Y was at 44 St. George or 12 Major. 12 Major had the group.
Near college.
Yeah. Major had clubs, and we had club meeting rooms there, and we held dances. And B'nai B'rith had the B'nai B'rith house on Spadina and the Crescent.
Okay. Oh, okay.
Just where Scott Mission is?
Yeah.
Right there.
Right. Okay.
So you had the funeral home and B'nai B'rith, Scott Mission, and the Silver Rail, or whatever it's called.
Not the so you did,
Silver Dollar.
So you did a lot of stuff as a group of young people.
So we all belonged to clubs.
Yeah.
I belonged to Hannah Senish at B'nai B'rith. Oh. Jerry belonged to 103. He became Alf Gadol of AZA, that was head of AZA for the area. And I was treasurer and president of Hannah Senish. And we were in Hannah Senish. We were in B'nai B'rith from the time we were 13 till we got married. Both of us were in B'nai B'rith. We belonged to the Y. He belonged because he played basketball and all that. And I went there because I knew a lot of the other kids, but I didn't belong to the clubs there. And then we had dances at schools. The public schools, the high schools already would have dances.
The public schools too?
Too, yeah. And we started dating individually out of the groups.
Around what age?
13, 14.
Yeah, yeah. And what kinds of things would you do when you were dating?
We'd go to a movie. Not me. I didn't go to movies too well.
What do you
mean? I wasn't a good movie goer. I get to the cashier and then I say to the guy, I'm not going in.
You didn't want to go in. You had some anxiety.
The
big dark room.
I don't know what it was. Some of the movies just didn't sit with me.
Yeah.
So I went to the movies later on, but for years I didn't go to the movies.
Uh-huh.
I'd go see Donald Duck, but I couldn't take the other stuff.
Yeah.
So, but we'd have parties. And so we'd go to the parties. The kids would go to the movies. We went on to picnics, moonlight cruises on Lake Ontario.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So
especially when she went with one guy and I went with a chick.
but we went we'd gather at people's homes.
So a lot of it
even
was,
though we were a couple,
yeah,
it was, still took place at people's homes. We put the radio on and danced to the radio.
What were the dances? Do you remember the dances?
Yeah, Jitterbug,
Rumba,
Tango.
That we do a lot of parties.
Yeah, yeah.
Holding
hands, kissing.
Oh yeah, big time. Oh yeah. My father was funny. We'd been dating for a while. He came to teach me algebra, actually.
And Jerry came to teach you algebra.
He was my girlfriend's boyfriend when they broke up, and he started to teach me algebra. And they got him to be my host at my surprise sweet 16.
Oh my God!
That they made me. So, anyways, we were dating for a while, and he's saying goodnight one night. My father's looking at him. He says, "And you're not going to kiss her goodnight?"
So I guess that was permission.
Not that he hadn't done it, just wasn't going to do it for my father.
That's a delightful story.
But there was a lot of individual dating, and you were introduced by other people in other groups. We were very groupy at that time. Mm-hmm. You didn't go there. Today you go to bars, and I don't know what the kids do. You go to these concerts and that. We went to B'nai B'rith. We went to the Y and to school.
So the organizations that were in place,
that's how we met our friends. Most of us met our prospective husbands that way. Yeah. Or we were introduced by somebody from another group or
whatever. Well, and you know, when you showed me the picture, said this person's married to this person.
And
this.
Most of us went to school together.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or lived in the area.
So it was a very powerful,
very
tight community.
Very.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She can go up and down Major Street and tell you pretty well.
Well, I think this list that you gave me. Well,
yeah, there's a lot not in there.
Yeah, no, I don't need one.
Because a lot of them aren't alive.
Just in the neighborhood, corner stores, do you recall some? I'm not talking about College Street.
No, so on Major, the one at Ulster, it's Ulster and Major, on the southwest corner was a store. But we never, I know it was there, but we never went up there for anything. And then there was that, if you went further up at Sussex, Barbara Pell's parents had a store at Sussex and Major. Mm-hmm. Those are the only two I knew on Major. On Robert was the one right across from Lansdowne School at the end of the lake. Maybe there was other ones on Robert, I don't know.
Yeah.
On Brunswick, was there a corner store on the street?
They were big houses.
They were big houses. There was no store. There was the shul, like the Rabbi Langer's first arrival. The stores, well, there was. At the corner of Harvard and Brunswick, on the northwest corner, was Greenspan's Butcher. That was one brother. The other Greenspan's was at Brunswick, around the corner at Brunswick, 7 Brunswick, and College. That was another kosher butcher, the two Greenspan's. Next, just up the street from Greenspan, was Goldie Tenenbaum's parents. They had a chicken place there. Now, there may have been grocery stores there, I don't know.
Yeah, but there were so many little specialty shops.
Yeah, always.
So you got your chickens here
and the butcher there, and the bakery. Yeah. A Harvard bakery was there forever. Kushner's fish store was next door.
Oh, yeah, I heard that fish store.
That was the restaurant. Basil Zeitz is now the Japanese restaurant at the corner of Major and Harvard on the northwest side. Mm-hmm. That was Zeitz's convenience store. There were more on Harvard, but I didn't know them all.
But lots of little stores.
Yeah, lots of little stores. Yeah. Dressmakers. There were dressmakers too.
Do you remember when the Second World War ended?
Yes.
Tell me, what do you remember?
We were in a place called Bronte, Cash's Farm. We were renting a cottage there that summer. My birthday was August 6th, and the Japanese did the bomb that day, 45. And we were at Cash's Farm, and we heard on the radio. So we made these big signs. And my cousin Dorothy Wasserman was there, and the Tort kids, her cousins, were there, and a whole load of us. And we all went out on the highway with these signs to show, because there were cars coming, and maybe they didn't know, because they didn't really have radios in their cars in those days. And they would stop.
What did you have on the sign?
The war is over. I don't think there's any pictures of it, because who had a camera?
But you made signs.
We made signs and we held them up there.
I was in camp.
You were in camp, but
my parents. But you remember it?
Oh yeah.
You do.
Oh yeah. And in May, May 7th, when the that was the European War. The that war was over. I don't remember where I was that day. I don't know why. I just don't remember that one. I think there was a lot of... I don't know if I was in the house at school or what, when we heard that the war, that part of the war was over. But the one in that summer, I really remember. Because I was 11.
We weren't in school.
No, and we weren't in school. But during the war, right after the war, it was very interesting. And during the war, there was a lot of blackouts.
Oh, yeah.
So they would, and it, we had air raid sirens.
Right.
And we made things in school. We were making stuff for the soldiers. Like we would get together money and we'd make bags and we would put toothpaste and personal items, and the all these things would be given to the soldiers. I don't know if every soldier did it.
Penny bank.
And then we had penny banks. So it was a lot of war effort put in where families and children could do things for the war effort. And knitting. I learned how to knit. We all made our own socks, our own sweaters, and things.
And we made stuff for the war also?
We made the socks for the guys.
For the guys.
Yeah. And then after the war. And after the war, when you found out that if you had family. So my mother, my father had one brother who lived in France. And we found out he was alive. So I remember we would buy groceries. My mother would put money in the flour, and she would put a box together that of goodies to send them. And then you would take a sugar sack, and she would put the sugar sack over the box, and then she would put more paper over the box.
But she was sending money.
We would send money
in the sugar and flour
to my uncle.
It was cash that your mother was sending.
It wouldn't be a lot.
Yeah.
$10, $20, whatever. And you would send it to my uncle. And then after the war, when the immigrants started coming in, there were places in Toronto where they would come. And my mother and my aunts would go down to the houses on Cecil, wherever the people were bringing them into Canada. And maybe some of them didn't have family. And you went there looking for family because not everybody had an address, but they knew somebody lived here. And we found distant relatives that way.
Amazing.
And then you helped them.
Your father got over.
And my father, there was a whole bunch of people that they helped.
So they would go. That's where they brought the immigrants, the Jewish immigrants.
Different house.
And you would, and you sometimes found family members.
Yeah.
Remarkable.
Yeah.
At that time, was there any effect of having the university so close to your neighborhood? Or were you aware of any effect?
We knew the university was there, and we were very happy when somebody could go there.
Oh, yeah.
But my brother, there was, when he decided to become a lawyer, he wasn't going to go anywhere else. He was going to the University of Toronto. I mean, there was Osgoode and there was Toronto, University of Toronto, but he chose to go to University of Toronto. And in those days, it wasn't as difficult to get into the universities because there weren't that many people applying.
Yeah.
So your chances of going to the university of your choice was much better.
So you're saying it was easier
it
then.
It was much easier.
It wasn't then. Like one out of every 10 getting
in. No. Yeah. For medicine, it was still a problem. Because they would go to the University of Toronto if they lived here.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of them graduated at Johns Hopkins or they would go to the States. Yeah.
They couldn't get in right away.
But it was hard. Like, after the war, for a lot of professions, it was harder. What happened, when the soldiers came back from the war and they were given a preference to go to a university or a college to get a profession if they didn't have one, so my cousins...
Even if they didn't go to high school.
Yeah, they were given choices. So three of my cousins decided they want to go to become optometrists. Two got in. The third one didn't.
What?
There was no room.
Yeah.
Because there was a limit on how many Jews were allowed.
That's just what I was
That was the limit.
The quota.
So the quota... Harry Wasserman and Henry Shanfield, they were first cousins. They got in. Moish, Harry's brother, my cousin Moish, he's still alive, he couldn't get in. He was in the Air Force, but he couldn't get into optometry. He was getting married, so he didn't bother to finish, to go in.
But, so the quota was cut off at some point.
I think it was 8 Jews
okay. In
those days
were
allowed into optometry school.
Right. So.
And maybe in medical school, 10.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that from Montreal.
Yeah.
I just want to move on to one more thing, and that is, and I don't know if you have a sense of what it's like now, but the safety, the livability of being down in the core of the city. How safe was it?
We felt very safe.
Uh-huh.
There was anti-Semitism, and I encountered it, but I didn't feel distressed like I would feel now. I mean, I was going to Shula one day, and it was on Brunswick, and sometimes my mother would give me a nickel to go buy a cinnamon bun or something before I go into Shula. So I remember eating this cinnamon bun standing there before I went up to my class, and this boy started yelling at me, "You dirty Jew." And I'm yelling back at him, but he didn't hit me or anything. So that was one time that I didn't feel really safe.
Mm-hmm.
But generally I felt safe, but there was a lot of anti-Semitism that wasn't always directed at me, but I heard it.
And I knew so you it heard about that. It, but you didn't
and
experience it
that was
it
the
very
first
much.
Time I ever experienced that.
Yeah.
The next time I experienced something, I was already older. Mm-hmm. I was working at Laura Lee Ladies' Wear on Young, next to the Lowe's Theater.
Laura Lee?
Laura Lee.
Laura Lee.
Robinstorm, like my cousin's sister's place. And I have a tendency to get very dark, and I had curly hair. And I went across the road to the restaurant for lunch where, you know where the Eaton Center is at Young and Queen? So there was the Eaton store there, but at the corner was Woolworths, and the Eaton store, Reitman's, there was a laneway, and there was a restaurant, and a shoe store, and I worked across the road next to the store, and the, so I'd go across sometimes for lunch if I didn't bring lunch on a Saturday. I worked there Saturday. I worked 3 jobs then, so I worked there Saturday. Was I with you yet?
I think so.
So I went across for lunch one day, and I'm at the counter, and they're not serving me. So I go, "Excuse me, I've got to get back for lunch. Why aren't you serving me?" And the guy says, "We don't serve blacks here." I look at him, I said, "Are you crazy? First of all, I'm not black, and what right have you got not to serve anybody?" I says, "I'm on my lunch hour. Are you going to serve me or not?" So, and I was hungry, so he served me. I never went in there again.
What year was that?
I think it was 54, 55.
No, we got married in 54. It had to be before we were married.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was before we were married. Maybe it was 52.
So it wasn't you being Jewish. It was
being
racist.
Black.
Wow.
And in those days, they didn't like you to mix black and white.
Uh-huh.
There wasn't a black... We had black friends, but if you went in... I worked for Quinter Foods at the time. And my bosses owned a restaurant called Sammy's on Spadina. That's how I got the job. They had the restaurant, and they didn't want the blacks coming in with the whites. So he was putting a 50-cent... minimum on the table, figuring that would discourage them, because there was still the discrimination.
Yeah, for sure, yeah.
My mother rented rooms. One day she rented, a couple came from Vancouver. The guy was Chinese, the girl was white. The neighbors didn't like that very much either.
So your mother rented it to them, but the neighbors disapproved?
They saw them coming in and out of the house. They told my mother no in certain terms. They was.
Oh my God. So did your mother have to?
She didn't do anything. She's none of your business.
Oh, so your mother was tough.
Oh, yeah.
When she had to be.
Yeah.
A little tough.
Wow. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's none of their business.
Yeah.
I'll do what I want. It's my house. But there was this discrimination there.
So you're talking about
in the 50s.
They didn't want Asian. They didn't want blacks, Jewish. They didn't want blacks.
Yeah. But that was the Toronto.
That was the Jewish area.
Yeah, but I'm saying Yonge Street, that was the commercial area.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that was...
But generally speaking, in this neighborhood...
Okay. In our neighborhood, I never really felt unsafe.
Okay, yeah.
I never had that feeling.
Yeah. Now, we're going to conclude. I'm just wondering if... when you agreed to speak to me and you were thinking about we were going to have this conversation and you were going to be sharing your observations, your experiences... Is there anything that I did not ask you about that you had thought about that you thought, oh, I have to tell Eleanor this? Is there anything either of you can think of?
Well, just that, the schools that we went to, so you predominantly went to from that neighborhood that you're doing.
Yeah.
So my friends mostly went to Lansdowne or to King Edward. King Edward was on Bathurst, just north of college. Lansdowne was on Spadina, just north of college.
Right, it's
those
on Robert
were the
Street.
Two major,
right, right, yeah.
Robert
yeah.
and Spadina.
Yeah.
And those were the two major schools.
Elementary schools, yeah.
And then the high school in the area was Central Tech at Harvard and Bathurst, Harvard and Borden.
Right.
So that was your technical school.
Yeah, yeah.
And to go to Harvard was on Palmerston, Euclid, and Harvard, and to go to Commerce, you had to go all the way over to Shaw, south of Harvard.
And that's where you went.
Right. So that was the area of schools.
Mm-hmm.
And you were confined. Those were the schools you had to go to. There was no moving around.
There was an area, but depending where you lived.
Yeah.
So you went to the school in your neighborhood.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's... And it wasn't just the kids from college, Spadina and Bathurst. It went south also. The kids in Kensington and Spadina and going east would use Lansdowne. Some finally went over to Huron Street maybe. And he went to Charles G. Fraser. He was another area. It all depends what area you lived in. They had it sectioned off by wards and
right.
by...
So you went to your neighborhood
school. Neighborhood schools, yeah. always.
Just
you couldn't move
talking
around.
Talking about your neighborhood.
Yeah.
In her class, there was a tremendous amount of success.
Yeah, the kids that came out of my school year, for that era, you had Alan Lindebaum who became a big judge. His brother Sidney, a few years later, became a judge. You had doctors, you had dentists, Jerry Gray. He wasn't in my school, but you had the kids who are now in their 70s really accomplished a lot.
Yeah.
We had very bright students. Some became professors in the States.
So the immigrant parents came over. You lived in crowded quarters.
Right.
The parents worked hard. They had high expectations, and you did not disappoint your parents.
No.
Oh, yes, you did.
If you didn't attain those expectations.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was supposed to be a lawyer. Never did.
Yeah.
But I'm saying the expectations, and we had a great, I thought we had a great childhood. I mean, we never knew anyone who had anything better than us.
Yeah.
We were all in the same situation. Maybe somebody had a little bit better, but we all thought that was life. When we were getting married, we thought, boy, he's going to have a job and I'm going to have a job and we've got a house. I mean, saved up money
yeah.
and had a house. How good was that? And then we were able to buy a car a year and a half later.
But
I mean, we worked hard.
We bought our house. No. I, with my father and father-in-law, went to see the house 3 days before we were married. And we bought it.
Whoa.
And she saw it.
Yeah.
And she says, I'm not going to marry you.
I hated it. Oh, my God. So what happened?
We lived there 3 years.
We got married.
So you did marry him, but 3 years later you moved out of it.
Yeah, we had to.
Yeah.
Because you didn't like it.
Well, I didn't like the house was number one.
Yeah.
it was infested with mice, but we had two children. There was nowhere to put them. Three small rooms on the main floor. And
okay, I'm going to turn this off for now. I just want to say this has been entertaining, delightful, and very informative. It just thank
good.
You.
I'm
thank
glad.
You both. Thank you both very much. I enjoyed it, and you've given us an excellent, wonderful information.
If I remember anything else, or if you want any more, tell me. I don't remember everything now.
Yeah.
So I'm Frances Gotkin. I lived at number 24 Major Street from 1941 till I got married in 1954. And at that time, in 1941, there was 12 people living in our house. And subsequent years, it went up and down from 12 to maybe more.
Oh, my God. Amazing. Okay.
But we were quite a number of people in the three-story house with one bathroom.
Thank you very much.